I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. College students in Florida rallied today outside the Seminole County Courts building, calling on prosecutors inside to arrest George Zimmerman.
Arrest Zimmerman now! Arrest Zimmerman now!
George Zimmerman is the 28-year-old Neighborhood Watch volunteer who claims he shot 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in self-defense 3 weeks ago. Today on the Today Show, Trayvon's mother gave her opinion.
He was reacting to the color of his skin. He committed no crime. My son wasn't doing anything but walking on the sidewalk. And I just don't understand why this situation got out of control.
Trayvon was on his way home to a relative's house inside that gated community in Sanford near Orlando when he was shot. Last week, bowing to family pressure, police released 911 calls, including this one made by George Zimmerman, to a dispatcher telling him there was a young man acting funny.
Which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Zimmerman has not been arrested, in part because Florida is one of 15 states with a Stand Your Ground law. We're going to hear more about that from Mark Simpson, news director for WMFE in Orlando, Florida. Mark, those 911 calls seem to have really escalated this.
I think hearing the audio has really pushed forward the community sentiment that something awful truly has happened here in Sanford.
Well, in part because one of the calls, there were many calls to 911. On one, you can actually hear in the background a voice crying out for help. Trayvon's mother says it's him. Let's listen.
I can't see him. I don't want to go out there. I don't know what's going on. So they're sending.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right, what is your
number? Just gunshots.
George Zimmerman says he's the one that was crying out for help. And yet, Trayvon was not armed, was he?
No, Trayvon Martin was not armed. He was said to only be carrying a bag of Skittles, and that's what the students who were out protesting today in Sanford were armed with themselves. They carried signs, they were chanting, and they all had bags of Skittles as a sign of solidarity.
Well, this brings us to the Florida law, as we said, one of 15 states that has the Stand Your Ground law, which we're being told by legal experts is different from the Castle Doctrine. The Castle Doctrine, which many states have, means basically you can protect your home if someone crosses the threshold. Stand Your Ground takes that doctrine into the street. It moves the Castle Doctrine to the street, we've heard. So give us some sense of this law in Florida.
Well, it was controversial when it was brought up in the Florida legislature. That was when Governor Jeb Bush was in Tallahassee. And it was pushed forward in large part by the Florida Sportsmen Association, a woman named Marion Hammer, who was formerly affiliated with the NRA, came forward with this bill, and they hedged it as a self-defense law that would make things safer, but a lot of the pundits were very skeptical about how this new law would change the way cases are handled in Florida and what would happen if a situation came up very similar to this where it wasn't clear if self-defense was truly the motive behind the shooting. And it got dubbed the Wild West Bill.
Well, and bring us right up to this moment. What are state officials considering right now in the case of Trayvon Martin?
Well, it's not clear what is going on with state officials at this point. The case has been handed over to the state prosecutor's office. No arrest has been made. No charges have been filed. So we're kind of in a holding pattern.
Well, Mark, we know that city officials are going to meet tomorrow with an official from the U.S. Justice Department, state prosecutors reviewing the case to see if there's evidence for a self-defense claim. You've talked to the family. What do they want?
They want an arrest of George Zimmerman. They say they want justice to be served, and they're still in a process of grieving. They had some remarkable stories about this young man who was 17 years old. His father told me that Trayvon actually pulled him out of a burning kitchen when he was 9. They say they don't trust Florida law enforcement officials, and that's why they're asking the U.S. Justice Department to get involved.
Well, the lawyer today on the Today Show said, how can you chase someone and then claim self-defense? We'll keep an eye on this case. Mark Simpson, news director for WMFE in Orlando, Florida. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Jason Russell, co-creator of the Christian charity Invisible Children, which produced that Kony 2012 video, was taken into custody by police Friday night after he was found naked and pounding the sidewalk outside his home in San Diego. His family says criticism of the film may have driven him over the edge. Kony 2012 became the most successful viral video ever, watched by over 80 million people on YouTube. It's an impassioned plea to bring down Joseph Kony, whose Lord's Resistance Army abducted thousands of children and forced them to be child soldiers in Uganda in the 80s and 90s. One of those kids, a boy Jason meets named Jacob, had a brother dying, trying to escape from Kony.
But now I miss you. So it is better when we meet. We are going, even if we are not going to meet, but we may meet in heaven. You see? I don't.
Everything in my heart told me to do something. And so I made him a promise.
We are also going to do everything that we can to stop them.
Jason Russell says he's spent the last 9 years living up to that promise, organizing young people, selling bracelets and posters, using his toddler son to tell the story, lobbying Washington. In fact, the Obama administration sent U.S. troops to act as military advisors in Uganda last October. Kony 2012 is meant to culminate this April 20th with a blanketing of the world with Joseph Kony posters. So what could be the criticism? Well, Jason mentions briefly in the film that Kony is no longer in Uganda. He's moved to other African countries. But that's not enough for Ugandans. When it was shown in the town of Lira, they threw tomatoes and stopped the film. Angelo Izama is a reporter for the Daily Monitor, Uganda's leading independent newspaper. Angelo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Robin.
You know, Americans, especially young Americans who've signed up for this initiative, you know, they're wearing the bracelets, they're putting up posters with Kony's name. They can't understand the criticism. So can you just sum it up for us?
I think that the immediate response of people who watch the film in Uganda is that it is not about Uganda. There is no war there. The film gives that impression. The conflict has got new victims. We think that the focus should have been there. And many Ugandans would have liked the Invisible Children to recognize that the effort of locals, particularly church leaders and local politicians, to make the solution to the problem a political and a peaceful one. And since Invisible Children had been promoting, even more militarization of the region, some folks were pretty much upset about that.
Is it a matter of maybe even national pride? Do they not want their country portrayed this way right now?
Well, Uganda has suffered a negative image, partly because of our own faults. Joseph Kony and other rebel organizations have emerged out of the civil wars there. Most people recognize the name Idi Amin, who was the poster child for dictators in Africa, who was also Ugandan president in the 70s. Certainly in this recovery period, I can understand why people feel that a film that draws attention to Uganda should have been accurate in its portrayal of the present circumstances, and even then recognize Uganda's own contributions to the end of this conflict, which is that the Ugandan military is right now the principal agent dispatched after Joseph Kony, wherever he is in the Central African Republic.
This is the criticism that we've heard from a lot of corners, that because the film focuses on the white American filmmaker and his young white son, it plays into a sort of a stereotype of Africans needing the white man to come in and save them. Is that a part of the reaction on the part of Ugandans?
I think a lot of Ugandan elites have the sense that, you know, for a long time, the aid industry have promoted this idea of Africans as sort of little children needing to be taken care of, and that, you know, they'll be saved by white benefactors abroad. But I had some of the people who watched the film in Lira, where when it was shown, there was a really negative reaction. And I think that the ordinary people, their main issue is that, hey, this film is really not about us. It is about some white guy with his son. But also the film doesn't really tell our story. which was a much more complicated story, that the people who suffered the Lord's Resistance most horrific crimes were kept locked up in so-called protection camps where they were not protected. About 2 million people for almost a decade and a half. And they, most of them died from disease and other problems, not so much the actions of the rebels. And for that, they blame not so much the LRA, they blame their government.
Let me get to some of the criticism of some of the things that you said. There are people who say, while it might be understandable that Africans might feel that this is reinforcing the stereotype that they need help from outside the country, in a way it would be like Germans, you know, during World War II, saying, don't come and help us with Hitler because, you know, we should be able to do it ourselves.
Well, first of all, that is not based in fact. By the time there was an intervention there, there was a crisis in Europe. Joseph Kony is just a symptom of state failure in that area. To make this about Joseph Kony is to miss the big picture, and most people are correctly upset about this because, first of all, even where he is, Joseph Kony is a minority. I can tell you there are about 12 rebel groups around that area, and even the elimination of Joseph Kony from that conflict won't end the suffering of the people within that area.
And by the way, you have said that the other criticism you have is that you want the focus to be on some of the problems that Uganda is facing now, in particular with some of these former child soldiers who are now suffering all sorts of different problems. For instance, nodding disease. Go through some of the things that you would like people to know about now about Uganda.
For instance, people have left the camps and have been returning to their homes. There are all manner of problems associated with rebuilding their lives, including that Gulu and the districts surrounding it have got some of the highest rates of HIV and AIDS. You talk about some of the former abductees and child soldiers. Many of them have had to migrate to the cities to take on jobs as security guards. Many of them remain unemployed within the streets of Gulu. There is a high incidence of not just ordinary crime associated there, but also, you know, child prostitution. I'll give you a really sad story about child wives of these rebels who are being rejected by their communities. Some of them are right outside of Gulu, not far from where Invisible Children has its offices. And they are today, you know, surviving as prostitutes. And then there's this nodding disease, which has affected largely people who have come out of the war-affected areas. No one knows what's causing it. CDC can't figure it out.
It's like a neurological disease. Are they sleeping? What's happening?
It is a form of narcolepsy or epilepsy and renders its victims as vegetables. It's affected 4,000 children. Most of them are born out of that conflict. So there are these contemporary problems right outside the offices of this charity. A little consultation would have helped assure people in northern Uganda that this charity not only was focused on Joseph Kony, but the aftermath of his of the hell that he has visited on these communities.
Welcome back to our conversation with Angelo Izama of Uganda's Daily Monitor newspaper about Kony 2012, that viral video that calls for a world response to Joseph Kony, who abducted thousands of children in northern Uganda before moving on to other African countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo or the DRC. American Jason Russell formed the Christian charity Invisible Children and made Kony 2012. He says it's oversimplified on purpose, but critics say it has a whiff of white man's burden, to which columnist Nicholas Kristof, a big supporter, says, this isn't a white man's burden, it's a human burden. Angelo, you've been telling us why Ugandans don't like the film, but do they know about it?
Well, not much. It's just beginning to dawn on Ugandans just how much the world has paid attention to the film. Remember that in the 90s, when the LRA was doing some of its havoc, we had probably just about 12,000 telephone landlines. Today, we have got about 14 to 15 million mobile phones, but internet penetration is still very low. Few people have watched it, and those who have responded really badly.
Well, one who has seen it hasn't, and that's Jacob, the former child soldier who's at the heart of the film. I'm sure you were aware of him. He defends the film. He says it's not too late because this fighting and suffering is going on elsewhere. He welcomes this attention.
Any attention on what's going on in the DRC is welcome. But to say that this is a silent war, it's just a fallacy. Joseph Kony has been indicted by the International Criminal Court. Conflict in that region has been on the agenda of the United Nations and every other person for a very long time. And Uganda has got 4,000 troops after Joseph Kony.
There are those who support the charity but still worry a little bit about the impact. Journalist Liz Wainwright worked with Invisible Children. She said they've had a huge impact in your area in Uganda, well-respected by other NGOs. Her worry, though, is that if there is a military move against Kony, it'll be children that will be guarding him.
That's quite true. There is a gentleman who's being put on trial in Uganda called Thomas Kwayelo. He rose to become one of the LRA's top commanders, but he was abducted at the age of 13. And one wonders, you know, how much responsibility he bears. As for high schoolers, all these young children who are interested in what Invisible Children has done with this film, the criticism that has come on the wake of the film has also, you know, opened their eyes to other narratives. And that this is in fact a good thing. Well, I often have trouble, you know, getting the attention of outsiders to this part of the world. And I think that if they're beginning to learn about what is going on by hearing our criticism of this film, that too is an advantage, and I welcome it.
Well, Ida Sawyer, who's a researcher for Human Rights Watch in Congo, says that while she supports the film, she says it also might take attention away from another problem, which is her concern that there may be human rights abuses by the Ugandan army. Others are saying that the Ugandan army might have recruited some of the former child soldiers from Kony's Lord's Resistance Army. So do you worry that President Obama has sent a small number of military advisors to help the Ugandan military fight and find Kony? Many people in the U.S. were surprised to hear that announcement this fall.
I am not surprised. As a matter of fact, by the time the Bush presidency was ending, what we were hearing from the White House was that it was pretty determined then to go after Kony specifically. Speaking to that, you would say that what the film has done is drawn American attention to what has been a largely quiet engagement by the U.S. Government in that part of the world. And I would add that there are many other issues associated with the militarization of Central Africa. As you know, that is one of the most lucrative pieces of real estate in the world right now. At the border where these rebels are operating, Uganda has just discovered a world-class oil field. And there is concern by many people that increased militarization in a resource-rich area has its own problems. Joseph Kony, he operates like a mercenary. Like most rebel groups in this area, it depends on who is paying them and supplying them. Joseph Kony has exploited the envy and the competition of neighboring governments to continue plying his trade. He's not the only one. The focus of international intervention, whether by the court or by this film, is really on the enforcers, not so much the mafia bosses. They leave the conflict entrepreneurs alone.
A couple last questions. Do you worry that Uganda and might be finding itself in some kind of holy war? The filmmaker of Kony 2012 is an evangelical Christian. Joseph Kony claimed to be a Christian channeling the voice of the Holy Spirit. B.E. Wilson writes on the site alternate.org that Invisible Children has received hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations from conservative Christian groups that funded things like Prop 8 in California, which outlawed gay marriage in California. And we know that Christians were accused of pushing Ugandan lawmakers to considering a law that would have outlawed homosexuality.
These are interesting sideshows way before Invisible Children. As you know, the Bush presidency controversially promoted abstinence with regard to Uganda's fight against HIV/AIDS. In the case of Uganda, there is no large ideological or religious element to this. There is no holy war. These rebels and their friends, governments and their allies, are engaged in basically competition over power and over resources. Mm. And that is really as plain as it comes.
What do you think is going to happen on April 20th?
Well, in Uganda, I am not sure. I have added my voice to that of many other people saying that because of local sensitivities that they should call off their Uganda activities. Beyond that, I had a small exchange with the Ugandan Prime Minister, and I've spoken to, you know, people who are on the ground. They think that attempts to get this rebel out of that conflict zone are proceeding quite well, and well before this film was put on the map. And our hope is that this whole chapter of Joseph Kony comes to an end, so that people can attend to the real challenges facing the country and facing the region.
Angelo Izama, a reporter for the Daily Monitor, Uganda's leading independent newspaper, commenting on Kony 2012, the internet sensation. Angelo, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
In what's being described as a brazen attack in broad daylight, a gunman shot dead a rabbi, his two sons, and another child at a Jewish school this morning in the French city of Toulouse. A teenage boy was also seriously injured. Witnesses say the attacker drove a scooter, as did the killer of three French soldiers in two separate incidents in the same part of France last week. And we're understanding that forensic evidence now may be showing that the same gun was used in one of those attacks. The BBC's Kate Davenport joins us from Toulouse. Kate, have I got that right, that this is perhaps the same exact gun, not the same type of gun being used?
Well, yes, early reports had pointed to a similarity. They'd seen that some of the empty shells were the same type of gun, but now it seems that police forensics have now said that it is the same gun, so there definitely seems to be a link between these three different shootings.
And potentially a serial killer. Well, what might be the link between the victims?
Well, in the first two shootings, they were a completely different type of target. These were young men, military men, paratroopers who were serving in Afghanistan off duty. The only thing is that they were all of different racial origin. One was from Martinique, so was black and a Muslim faith, and the other two were of North African origin. And a third man was also shot and has now died, and he was also of North African origin. So there does seem to perhaps be a racial link, but obviously nobody was expecting children to be targeted, and nobody was expecting Jewish people to be targeted either.
Well, and tell us a little more about what happened in that attack on the Jewish children and the rabbi at the school.
Well, at 8 o'clock this morning, children were gathering at the school for morning prayers, and in fact it was a college and lycée, so mostly children from 11 to 18, but it was also a drop-off point for nursery and primary age school children, so young children were present as well. And that's just at the moment that the attacker came in on his black scooter and opened fire. He got off his bike and went into the courtyard and seemed to indiscriminately shoot at both an adult rabbi and his children, and then other victims. One girl was shot in the back, tried to run away, and was finished off with a shot in the head, so completely cold-blooded.
Yeah. Well, France has the largest Jewish community in Western Europe, about 500,000 people, the largest Muslim population in Western Europe, about 5 million. Toulouse is home to the largest communities of both groups. I mean, we know French President Nicolas Sarkozy went to the school this morning. He condemned the shootings. But what's being done, especially given the sense that there may be somebody targeting these two groups of people?
Well, obviously, there's heightened security, very, very high security now. There already was heightened security after the previous killings, but that was expected. We expected the targets to be military and young men in their 20s, so a completely different target. Now it affects the whole community, and schools are being very, very, very strictly secured, mm-hmm. and all religious establishments. There's going to be a service at a synagogue at 5 o'clock this afternoon. There does seem to be unity among the political leaders. This is a time ahead of presidential elections in France, where there has been some members of the political parties have been accused of playing the race card, and the National Front right wing group has just got enough votes to put forward a candidate. However, there's no clear link to right-wing groups. It could be a terrorist attack as well because of the the anti-terrorist groups are now working on the program as well.
That's the BBC's Kate Davenport on today's shooting in Toulouse, France. And the discovery, the forensic discovery that bullets were used in, or the same weapon was used in earlier shootings. Kate, thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Okay, thank you.
Did you hear this weekend's This American Life retraction of monologuist Mike Daisy's story about Chinese factories that make Apple products? It was based on Mike Daisy's one-man off-Broadway show, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, which ended its run yesterday. Daisy got a standing ovation, but he cut some sections of the final show after his story was taken apart by This American Life host Ira Glass and Rob Schmitz, China Bureau Chief for Marketplace and American Public Media. In Daisy's original version, he described meeting workers who were as young as 13, touring cramped factory dorms, meeting workers whose hands shook uncontrollably because of a chemical they'd worked with, and being led on this tour by a woman named Kathy. He told Ira Glass her name was really Anna, and he couldn't find her again to fact-check. But the problem was, while the kinds of things Daisy describes have happened in China over the last 10 years, he didn't see much of them directly, and he made some things up. For instance, he said he made workers who said they were meeting to organize an illegal union at Starbucks. And that made Rod Schmitz laugh. Starbucks is even more expensive in China than it is in the U.S. We reached Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. And Rob, this started after you and other China correspondents heard Mike Daisy say when he arrived at this Foxconn factory in Shenzhen, he saw angry guards with guns.
I've never seen security guards with guns. And in fact, for security guards to have guns would be illegal.
Well, as you started to pull on this string, you started unraveling this story. Mm. And your people at Marketplace talked to Ira Glass and his people at This American Life. And as we heard this past weekend, the producers at This American Life really did quite a lot of vetting. One of the things Mike Daisy kept saying to them is that he couldn't locate the woman who was with him, who was his tour guide. They thought, if he can't find her, how can we find her in China? But you found her.
It was actually really simple. And of course, I think that Mike Daisy did not tell Ira and the producers there that her name was Kathy. He said he lied and said her name was Anna. I one day just Googled Kathy and translator and Shenzhen, the name of the city where Mike Daisy went. And the first result that came up had a phone number. I called the phone number. I confirmed that she had worked with Daisy, and then I asked her about the underage workers part of the monologue. She immediately said, this did not happen. That's a pretty big part of that monologue. And I asked her a couple of other questions, and she refuted those as well, the other details. And so I decided to fly to Shenzhen. I took a copy of the monologue with me, and we went to the gates of Foxconn, exactly where she took Mike Daisy. And I discovered that most of the details were, according to her, not true.
We have a clip here of you and Ira Glass now, both together interviewing Mike Daisy, talking about one of his claims that he talked to workers who'd been exposed to a poison called N-hexane in the manufacturing of Apple products. When you asked Kathy, she said, no, Mike didn't speak to these workers. He'd said their hands were shaking uncontrollably. Let's hear the exchange in this past weekend's program.
Now let's talk about the hexane poisoned workers. Kathy says that you did not talk to workers who were poisoned by hexane and were shaking uncontrollably.
That's correct. I met workers in Hong Kong going to Apple protests who had not been poisoned by hexane, but had known people who had been, and it was like a constant conversation that we were having about those workers. So no, they were not at that meeting.
So you lied about that? That wasn't what you saw.
I wouldn't express it that way.
How would you express it?
I would say that I wanted to tell a story that captured the totality of my trip. And so when I was building the scene of that meeting, I wanted to have the voice of this thing that had been happening that everyone been talking about.
So you didn't actually meet an actual worker who had been poisoned by hexane?
That's correct. Hexane.
That last voice, again, Mike Daisy, before that Ira Glass, and Rob Schmitz from Marketplace, talking about Mike Daisy's claims about what he saw in China. Rob, how, I mean, that sounded excruciating. How?
Yeah, it was. You know, the silences, I think, speak volumes.
Well, and what are we to make of it, Rob Schmitz? Because Mike Daisy said over and over again, look, I'm sorry I did this. I shouldn't have gone on This American Life. But the fact is that what I do is still valid. I try to paint a picture. And, of course, Ira Glass, you know, kept hammering him on that as well, that even if I go to a Broadway show, I think if someone says I went to a factory, that I believe they went to a factory. But Mike Daisy still maintains that what he does is more impressionistic. What does happen in these factories? What is true?
Factories in China are not fun places to work. That's definitely correct. However, they are not full of children making iPhones, and they're not, you know, as far as poisonings are concerned and explosions, you don't see that very often, especially with the supply chain for Apple, which uses a lot of multinational companies to make their products. You know, Foxconn is one of their biggest suppliers. When you talk to workers at Foxconn, which I have, Foxconn is pretty much at the top of the list. It's a place where they'd like to work because the alternative for them is either another factory or they can go back home and go back to farming, which is grueling, grueling work. You know, as a China journalist, it's really difficult to have someone like Mike Daisy come here for 6 days and then go back and lie to the media about what China's about. Because when you become a China journalist or if you're a China academic, you really have to invest a good part of your life to this country because it is a very difficult place to understand. It becomes almost an obsession. Someone like Mike Daisy, who comes over here for less than a week and comes back and disseminates all this information in the press, really makes our jobs much more difficult.
Have you felt that from Chinese officials? Do they know about this?
No, actually, for the most part, they don't know about this. This isn't something that they're paying that much attention to.
So you're saying your difficulty is in trying to get across what's true to American listeners?
I think that the public perception about this may have shifted because of what he's done. And it's difficult to convince people that the conditions are improving at factories. Because if I said that 2 weeks ago, before anybody knew that what Mike Daisy was saying was not true, what he saw was not true, I think a lot of people would have a problem with that idea. He has definitely had an impact on the public perception of this. And it'll be interesting to see how that public perception, if at all, will change.
Rob Schmitz, China Bureau Chief for Marketplace and American Public Media. Rob, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Robin.
I say Chick Corea, you say what? Well, it could be Grammy winner. He has 20, and this song, Renaissance, is off the CD Forever, which just won 2 Grammys, including Best Jazz Instrumental Album for Chick Corea, Stanley Clark, and Lenny White. You might say Return to Forever, the name of just one of Chick Corea's many groups. Or Miles, Jack DeJohnette, Gary Burton, the artist he's played with, like a star moving through a constellation. Or you might say Scientology. Chick Corea is one of the most prominent followers. He's written music based on the writings of L. Ron Hubbard. Or Explorer. Chick Corea's new CD is The Continents. The title work is the first studio recording of his concerto for jazz quintet and chamber orchestra, each movement named for a continent. So let's go to Africa. That's Africa off the Continents by Chick Corea. Originally commissioned in Vienna, it's now part of a 2-CD set. And Chick Corea joins us from his studios in Florida with more. Chick, welcome.
Hey, thanks.
So we understand this all started. You were invited to write a piano concerto for the, you pronounce it, Wiener Mozartjahr?
Yeah, I just, Mozartjahr, I give it, it's just the Mozart year. It was 2006, and the people in Vienna put a lot of funding and gathered a lot of support to present hundreds and hundreds of projects celebrating Mozart because it was Mozart's 250th birthday.
And you had some familiarity with the gentleman. We remember your Mozart sessions with Bobby McFerrin, Mozart, but also a lot of improvisation. So, you know, obviously this you responded to this.
Well, yeah, it was right center of my interests. Here was an opportunity to play in Europe and especially premiere it in Vienna, which was one of the main cities that Mozart lived and worked in.
So now you're writing this commission piece, and you know, you take us from Africa to Asia to America. We go through the continent. Why did you break it up that way?
This is kind of a secret that's not really a secret, because I'm telling you and the whole listening audience.
It's just between you and me.
So it's no longer a secret. But the way I made this piece was I just took the simplicity of the concept in the spirit of Mozart. And to me, Mozart's music was definitely in the spirit of the joy of creation. And I took that spirit and I wrote music in that spirit. Doesn't sound like Mozart's music. I never intended it to. But anyway, the piece came out to be in six definite movements, almost six different pieces, actually, that kind of go together to make a program. And when I was looking for a title for it, I then thought, you know, there's six or seven continents, depending on if you put the United States together with the Americas. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The Americas, if you put the Americas together, you've got six continents. And I thought, let me see if it fits this. And so in retrospect, what I did is I looked back over what I had written, and I immediately saw one that would be Europe. And I immediately saw one that would be Africa. And they all kind of slotted into place magically.
That's so funny, because I'm listening to the American one, for instance, and I'm thinking, oh, so here's his homage to the blues, you know, and here's a little bit of, you know, but it was backwards. It wasn't that way.
No, it was backward, but it was all part of the same time stream or not time stream or wherever that stream is. And it makes perfect sense to me. A lot of my titles come like that. I get the concept, I write the music, and then the symbols of words or images come after that.
The continents, and then as you write in the notes after the recording, you know, had some time left. You got it recorded far more quickly than you thought. So the quintet has an impromptu jam. And then you, Chicoria, sit down at the piano because there was something missing. And there's several tracks on the second CD of you, what, trying to do what?
There were just some thoughts I had about something incomplete in terms of areas of improvisation or areas of music. I don't know what it was, but it led me to the piano, and we had some time, and Bernie Kirsch, my engineer, turned the recorder on, and we recorded a bunch of piano solo stuff.
Well, I'm looking at the CD right now. Let's listen to a little bit. They're all called Solo Continuums, and then they have a different number. I loved on Solo Continuum 31, it's only about a minute long, but at about 40 seconds in, there's an exquisite chord change. Listen to that. And then it just stops, and it goes on Solo Continuum 42. '53. Down to here's Solo Continuum 1411. Now, does this mean you did this 1,400 times?
That's one of those jokes that I thought I'd throw out to the audience. They're just arbitrary numbers. They have nothing to do with anything.
Oh, thank goodness. But, but you know, you are looking. You're looking, and sometimes I'd be listening, and I'd be thinking, I think that was it right there, you know, but it's not it, apparently, or something. Did you find it?
I'm not sure that I was actually looking for something. I was actually just maybe more like completing a communication. Just there's something needed to be completed. There was something that got left over, and I kept playing until I felt it was done. I felt very happy. After I played that last one, I thought to myself, that's it. That's all I got.
How are you feeling at this stage? I mean, I'm sitting here, I'm having this sort of wave of names and music and things I've identified with Chick Corea, the different groups you've been in. And it does seem like a time in your life where if you want to do a concerto, you do a concerto.
Well, you know what's interesting about that? In actual fact, I've never lived my musical life any differently. It's always been that way from when I was a kid. And my parents gave me a lot of love and support and freedom, and they didn't force me to do what I didn't want to do. And somehow that became just a natural way of life for me. You don't have to be old to do that.
Pianist, composer, bandleader Chick Corea, his latest CD, it's actually two CDs, it's called The Continents. We'll have more at herenow.org. Chick Corea, thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thanks for the chat, and I appreciate you letting everybody know about The Continents. It's an unusual piece of music, probably not everybody's tastes, but it's from the heart, and it was a really, really great, fun project for me.